Welcome to the NASCAR and NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan. Today here at Joe Gibbs Racing, where we are talking to one of the hottest drivers right now in the Cup Series, Daniel Suarez. Daniel, thanks for making time.
Thank you, Nate. Thank you for having me.
I presumed coming here that you would be coming out of like a debrief, but I just learned that you were here yesterday doing the debrief. So thanks for coming in on what I'm sure is one of your rare times to have some little bit of off time from NASCAR. You were here yesterday, though, for that, and you're coming off two straight top fives. How's that feel to go into the debriefs when you're able to, like, give some, I would think, some good information and be a part of that discussion?
It's definitely way more fun when you have a strong weekend and when you have a speed and you can actually bring some information to the table. And not just the debrief, but as well when making your notes and when watching the race again and you know, going through all that process. When you have a bad weekend, you don't want to even do it. You don't want to go back and watch the race and see how bad you were doing. But when you have a strong weekend, it's always fun to see you know, how you did it and what can you do better next time and stuff like that. So it's been good the last couple of weeks. Definitely much better than 2 months ago, and hopefully We can keep working on this path and keep moving forward.
You were talking, Daniel, at Watkins Glen about how Kyle Busch has become a mentor for you, and there's been more of an exchange of information. But Kyle actually said as well, you know, during his media availability, that you ask all the right questions, but you also bring some good information. So, you know, you mentioned last year, I'm sure it was difficult when you probably came in here on a Monday a lot of times and didn't feel as if you were contributing much.
Yeah.
Is it just a marked change? And is it now that you're running better, are you able to approach Kyle and kind of like know exactly how to ask him what you're looking for? Because you kind of know what he's doing. You just need to know how to get to where you can do what he's doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a process. And, you know, I remember being in the Kyle position back when I was racing in Mexico, you know, several years ago. I was the kid, but I was the fastest guy all the time. So everyone was coming to me to ask me questions. And every time that those guys, most of the time when those guys were, you know, giving information and stuff, most of the time was good information, but a lot of time was information that I wasn't even listening. So, you know, I understand Kyle's position because obviously he's very fast. He has a lot of experience. And sometimes it's hard to let someone new that is not having the results yet to bring all that information because you don't really know if it's a good or bad information. But I feel like lately it's been better. We've been working actually closely with Kyle and with 18 guys, and that has been helping our program a lot. A couple of months ago, we just didn't have a lot of speed and we were struggling with consistency. And seems like right now we're rolling in the right path.
Right. And Kyle is not the only person to mention this, Daniel. We heard Matt Kenseth say this as well last year, that you came to him for questions. Like you were one of the only teammates really that he had who came so often and so frequently. Is it something that you learned when you were, you know, you talked about racing in Mexico and you were having other people ask you questions? Or are you an inquisitive person? Do you like asking questions? Do you like just sort of learning and gaining information, or is it just something you knew you had to do?
Well, I have never been a shy person, and I have a very good story on this because my very, very first race ever in go-karts, my mechanic was my father. And, you know, in go-karts, you have different sprockets, pretty much the year of the car for every different racetrack. So we were coming into this racetrack, and those sprockets, you have a number on it, right? So my father and myself didn't know heading into one racer. So we bought a few, but we didn't know which one to install. So he told me, we went to first practice, and, you know, one team was very fast. And he told me, hey, then you go over there and check what number they have in the sprocket. So I went over there. I was just 11 years old, and they had the number. They had a cover with a piece of tape. I said, man, I can't see the number. So I just went to the guy and said, hey, you know what? I'm new here, and I don't have the number of the sprocket. Can you give it to me? And actually, the guy told me it was very funny. That was the best team. And the next weekend, he went to my father and he said, you know what? Your kid has a lot of talent. I would like to have your kid in my team. And since that day, I guess I just ask questions and I am very straightforward. And you know, sometimes you get the right information, sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
But most of the times you do. So. I feel like, you know, it's been like that since I moved here to the United States, not just with the racing stuff, but as well with the language. So I guess it's been something normal for me.
So that sprocket you saw as a key to maybe running better and ended up being a key to joining a new team and having a great opportunity.
Actually, yeah, it was a chain of thing. And that team, actually, the owner of that team, you know, his name is Guillermo. His nephew ended up getting the race team a few years later. So I've been part of the same racing forever. And right now, still, every time I go to Mexico, his nephew, that is the owner of the team now, he's the one that has my car. He's the one that takes care of my car and everything. And it's been 15 years since then. So it's a lot of fun that sometimes we talk about all these stories and how they say this, man, you just went for it. I mean, we never had someone coming to ask for something that is supposed to be private, you know?
I mean, it would seem so basic, but I guess in racing, everybody tries to keep their secrets closely held, so you probably don't know what you can really ask
about, correct?
Right?
I mean, in NASCAR, it's like you go to Hendrick Motorsports and then you ask them, hey, how much camber do you have, or how much what kind of air pressure do you have, you know? It's something like that. So already they won't tell you,
right?
But I guess in go-karts they thought it was funny and they did.
And that's cool. Your dad was involved in that story as well. You said encourage you to ask that question. For those who maybe don't know, who are listening to this podcast, he worked on vintage cars, and that was his business as you were growing up. And I want to get into that a little bit, but was he involved in racing at all, or just through you? Is that he knew cars, but he just got involved in racing because of your passion for it?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, he still does vintage cars, classic cars and stuff, but no, nothing related with racing. He always liked cars, and that was just, you know, for fun, but nothing related with racing. I mean, at one point when he was around early 20s, he had a street car, and he was putting a different engine on it, and he was racing that thing a little bit in the dragway, but just for fun, you know, nothing professional at all. Actually, in Mexico, they have, on Wednesdays, they open the dragway for street cars, so he was going into those Wednesdays racing kind of thing. So it wasn't even, you know, racing a schedule. It was kind of like open for everyone.
Yeah.
So he was into that a little bit, so he always liked cars and engines and a little bit of racing, but he didn't know anything about it, and obviously they didn't know anything either.
And what was his reaction when you told him you wanted to start go racing go-karts, and what made you want to go?
Well, it's a long story, but one of his customers' son was into go-kart racing, and at the time, actually, I think it was when I turned 10 years old, my father bought me a go-kart, but for the street, you know, one of those little like buggies kind of thing with for the off-road and stuff. So I got that thing, and I remember that thing had a 9-horsepower engine, which is nothing.
Only about a tenth of what you have.
Yeah,
now. Yeah,
correct. And you know, it was fun the first week, but then after 1 week, I said to my father, hey, you know what? This thing, I think, is losing power. He said, no, man, it's not losing power. You are getting used to it. He said, no, man, this thing has no power anymore. It's not going anywhere. So anyway, I started talking to some friends of his, of my father, that they were mechanics and stuff. So one of them found me a bigger engine, like I think it was a 16 horsepower. So I did a swap in my mother's garage, and we started working on it. So I was always involved with all that kind of stuff. And then when my father's customer son was involved in racing, he invited me one day to go and practice with him, because he saw me in the shop just, you know, messing around. So he invited me one Saturday, and we went over there to test. I went over there with his son, and I wasn't supposed to drive. I was just going to hang out, and eventually they told me, hey, grab the helmet. Let's go there and do some laps. And I remember that it was my friend, and now, obviously, that he was racing professional. And it was his younger brother, too, that he was racing, you know, not as professional, but he was racing. So my first time out, I was already better than the other one. And I was close to the guy that was professional. So, and they started explaining to me how to do things. And actually, I was getting better. His father went to my father and he said, hey, you know what? Your kid is good. And for some reason, he was good out of the box. And he's been racing before. And my father said, no, never. So, you know, that kind of like put a little bit like issue to my father. And he let me go again with them. And eventually I was, you know, as fast as his son. And I was just racing. I was just, you know, testing for a few weeks. And eventually my father said, you know what, let's get into racing and let's sell your go-kart and let's buy one of those things and see what happens. And that's how everything started.
And he eventually sold his vintage restoration car shop to support your career.
Yeah, that was later. Yeah. You know, that was maybe actually not too long ago, maybe 5-6 years ago, when I was ready to move up into the NASCAR stuff in Mexico. Maybe a little bit more than 6, maybe 7 years ago. You know, I was in a point in my career that I didn't know what was next. And the next step was to race in stock car racing and in Mexico, because that was very strong. But we didn't have a sponsor, so he had to sell his shop and get that money with some other partners to put that racing together and get, let me go in. That made me good enough to race half of the season in Mexico. And my dad will tell you, his goal was for me to... He always told me this. He said, I mean, I'm going to put you out there, and you're going to do your job. And if someone give you an opportunity, that's great. If someone doesn't, that's all we can do, man. We don't have more. And luckily, the biggest team in Mexico is talking like, you know, Joey Racing or Henry Motorsports or, you know, one of the biggest teams. They call me in, right in the middle of the season. Hey, we would like to have you in a race team, which it normally doesn't happen. Normally, they call you at the end of the season, you know, to start a new season. So they call me in the middle of the season because they knew I was tied with budget. So they step out one of their full-time drivers, and they put a rookie 18-year-old in there, and that actually was the biggest step of my career, because in that point I said, okay, now I can start moving forward from here. And my dad, finally, he started relaxing a little bit.
At the same time, relaxing, but he no longer has his business. Like, what happens for him then? Did he just go into the workforce and work a job? Or?
Well, at the time, like I said, he had already his money invested in the race team. So I left, and he had one more driver in there.
Ah, okay.
So there was a two-car team. One experienced driver, he was winning races before he was on that team, and myself. So when I moved to this team, for a few races, I was kind of like up and down, and then I started doing better and then winning races. And then the following year, I was winning everything, winning the most races, winning the most poles, and winning everything. And that happened early in my career. I was just 18 years old. And my father told me, hey, well, what is next? And he would start having conversations about, you know, what we're going to do next. And at the time, I wasn't thinking about the United States. I was just, you know, trying to make my career in Mexico. But since everything happened early, we decided to move to the United States and try to, you know, make a career here. And it was very tough for a few years. I didn't speak English and, you know, finding opportunities, finding sponsors. My dad, actually, he did relax for a year, but he was back at it again, looking for a sponsor, but now for the United States. But at least at the point, I had my seat secure in Mexico, because I was doing very well, so I knew that seat wasn't going anywhere. So we started working in things here in the United States through different series, in the Canyon series. And then later on, I had my first opportunity with Joggy Racing, and finally full-time in 2015 with Joggy Racing. And I think on 15, we started talking about it. But on by the end of 15, early 16, my father and I decided to put the shop back together, the shop that he ended up selling. So now he has the shop back, and the race team that he had, he sold part of it, and he just has some part of that, because he told me that since I left Mexico, he thought the racing in Mexico was boring, because he liked it, you know, seeing myself there. And he said, man, since you're not here, it just doesn't make sense for me to be at the racetrack anymore.
Sure.
So he started, you know, losing some interest in that, and he sold part of his race team, and now he has some management in the series, some different stuff. But I know that what he likes a lot is the restoration shop.
Right, he's only in racing because of you.
it's been like a combination. We've been learning together, and we've been moving forward together. For sure, he didn't know anything about racing, and I didn't know anything either. So he told me many times. He said, "Man, I wish I can know where to go or how to ask, you know, sponsors for money and stuff like that." But he had no idea. And my family doesn't come from athletes either. Like, I don't have any family members that are doing anything in sports. So it was something 100% new for me and my entire family.
What does your family mostly do? I mean, obviously your dad restored cars. Are they just regular people who just work in regular jobs in Mexico?
My grandfather used to be a photographer. My mom, she works sometimes with one of her sisters in the real estate business. And, you know, my uncles, they one is in real estate, one is in actually insurance. I mean, nothing related with racing, nothing. That's it's been something new. I didn't have, growing up, my family is you know, average money-wise, and I didn't know any of my friends that was involved in racing. As you know, in racing it's a little expensive, so you need to have a lot of support to make it work. So I didn't know anyone involved with racing, but this guy that he wasn't in my school or anything. He was just a customer of my father in the shop, and his son was racing, and it was kind of funny and lucky how everything happened, because so many times in my career I have been in the situation where, man, I think I'm pretty much done about racing, because, you know, we don't have money, or we don't have sponsors, or we don't have racing, or we don't know what to do next. I mean, it's been like ups and downs a lot of times.
Probably a lot of times where you just thought, this is the end, I'm going back to Mexico.
I mean, like I say, when a big race team in Mexico got me, that was exactly in the middle of the season. That's something actually people don't know, but after that race, I was going to be done.
Oh, really?
And they called me on that race. It was kind of interesting. That was my last race, and I made a pole with my father, but I wrecked in the race. So I got wrecked in the race, but the team, even with that, the other team called me. So, you know, it's been tough. Yeah. I won't say it's been easy, but I feel like that has been helping me to develop the person that I am today.
Yeah, it's funny how it works out like that, Daniel, because I don't know if you've heard the Denny Hamlin story, but very similar. Like, he was at a late model race, he was racing for his family, and this was the last race they were ever going to do, and this guy named Jim Dean overheard him talking about it like when they were in the entry line or whatever, and he said, "You're not going to race anymore?" And he said, "Let me come race for my team," and that was the break that got him here. And I mean, I don't know, I guess some of it is happenstance, but some of it is that team is taking a chance on you, just like that owner believed in Denny's talent, that team believed in your talent. So,
yeah.
I mean, you can look at it as good fortune, but it's also good fortune because you're good.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a combination of things, but sometimes I think about myself and I think about how many kids out there have a lot of talent and you know, sometimes it's wasted because they don't have the right support or they don't have the right mm-hmm. people on the side. And, you know, for whatever reason, most of the time, at least in Mexico, I've been a lot of times in this situation. The kids that have the most talent, they don't have the money. Mm-hmm. And that's how it works most of the time, because I guess because those kids, they just drive their heart off every time that they have the opportunity. And I remember when I was racing go-karts in the very beginning, I had one go-kart with the same motor, with the same everything for years. And my competition, they were having two go-karts during the year and several engines and stuff. And I remember when I was 13 years old, I was good enough that other teammates in my team, they were telling me, "Hey, Danny, help me to set up my car." So I was setting up their cars on Thursday, Friday, and my car, my go-kart wasn't running at all because I had to save my go-kart, I had to save the motor, I had to save the tires. So my go-kart was going out just on Saturdays for the race. That was it. Yeah. Practice, official practice, and race. That was it. I didn't use my go-kart to test at all. I was testing with someone else, tires, someone else, engine, someone else, chassis, to, you know, take advantage that they wanted me to test their car, to put the right setup on it. But well, as well, because my engine, I knew that it had to last.
Right.
As long as possible.
Yeah.
So, you know, I spent years with the same stuff.
It's like, how do you get noticed when your equipment sort of limits you to some degree, right? Like, there's only so much you can do on the track because you need that.
Yeah, but so many times, I remember as well, one day we were racing in the rain. Most of the big teams in Mexico, they had two go-karts. It was raining, but it was kind of dry, and it was mm-hmm. like that. The big teams, they had two go-karts, one with dry and one with wet, because it's different setup too.
Yeah.
So we didn't have that. We had just the sway bars, the sway bars ready, the rain tires ready, and, you know, everything's swapping in very quick and stuff like that. I mean, it wasn't easy in that point because we didn't have the money to do it right, to do it in that level. But even with what we had, for me, it felt better that the kid that had less, he was kicking everyone's butt.
And of course, as you mentioned, you also had the support of your father. Is his name Alejandro?
Yeah.
Is that right? FS1 did this nice piece for Father's Day where he came and visited you, and you talked about the fact that you had helped him reopen that restoration shop in Mexico, and also talked about that you helped buy back this bus that he drove with your mother when she was pregnant with you from Texas back to Mexico. The same guy who bought it from your father just happened to still own it. You bought it for him. Why was that important to do, to get that for him?
Well, first of all, as you can know by now, I love cars as much as he does. And classic cars, for me, it's a lot of fun. It's kind of like my lifestyle, you know, and I just feel like that's who I am, you know. I like people looking at me in the street because of my car, and I feel like that's something very cool. So, and especially when they those cars are old and classic. So, you know, he had my mom pregnant or myself in a trip to Texas. My father used to go to Texas to buy parts or to, you know, to find cars. And one of my mom's sisters lives in Texas. So they were going, you know, quite a bit, and one day my dad found this bus in a little farm there, and he wanted to buy it. So he ended up buying it. So the next week, my mom and my father, they went. I think they were in a bus or something, like in a taxi cab kind of thing, from Mexico to Laredo, Texas, just to pick up that bus so they can drive it back. Anyway, they ended up going there, and then they drove the bus back all the way to Mexico. And my mom was there, obviously, and my mom was pregnant with myself. And then my dad, at that point, he was starting in the restoration business. And he ended up fixing that bus, you know, 100%. And 1 year after I was already born, I was a baby, that bus became the best bus in Mexico. I mean, it was famous. It was in newspapers, and my dad's name actually started to go up because that bus. So it was very special. I have pictures of myself as a baby, like 1 year old, and as well two and a half maybe on that bus, just watching the bus with my father and you know, standing in the back seat of the bus and stuff like that. And you know, eventually he ended up selling the bus. But later on, maybe it's been a while, but maybe like 8 years ago, I told him, "Hey, where is that bus?" And he said, "Well, actually, the same guy I sold it to, he still has it, and the guy lives in my hometown." And one day, long time ago, we went to see it, and we were able to see the bus, like, in, you know, on the other side of the fence. I said to myself, "One day I'm gonna get that bus back." And I said that to my father, and he just laughed because I was little. And eventually, when things start to go well, maybe 3 years ago, I start looking for that guy. And my dad and I, we went to that guy and say, "Hey, how are you doing?" Obviously, the guy knows my father. He knows that my father built that bus and everything. And every person that knows about old cars, when they see that bus, they say, "Oh, yeah, this is Alejandro's bus. Doesn't matter who owns it. Yeah. Oh, yeah, this is Alejandro's bus because he built it."
Yeah.
And he made that thing famous. So eventually I went to the guy and said, "Hey, you know, this is special for me and for my father and my family. I would like to buy it." He said, no, I don't want to buy it. I have had this thing for 20 plus years and it's special for me too." I said, "Man, it's going to be tough." So I keep trying. And eventually, like a year ago, he told me, "You know what? He has a son. Like, his son is my age." And he said, "You know what? My son is the one that has it now. And he really wanted a lot." So I said, "You know what? Or either I'm going to buy it from you or I'm going to buy it from your son." So so it's going to be up to you one day. So we keep trying a little bit. And then after 6 months, I didn't try anymore. I knew that one day he was eventually give up. But after 6 months, he called my father. And he said, "Hey, you know what? We have some family personal plans here, family plans, or moving out and stuff in different houses or something like that. So I think we are thinking about selling the bus." So my father called me. That day I called the guy, and the next day we're making a deal on the bus, and we're bringing the bus back home. And you know, it's very cool for me because my father, he told me that he never thought that he was going to get it back. Mm-hmm. and I thought it was very cool. Actually, when I went to Mexico the last time to see the bus in person, like to drive it, and with my father and my father, he was already very excited.
Do you know the story of your teammate Eric Jones bought his father's? Yeah, I think it was a Camaro.
It's a Corvette.
Okay. Like very similar. Like yeah. He had to go to the guy who owned it then, and had to, and was the same guy who bought it from his dad, and had to plead with him. And
yeah, the same thing, man. As you know, I think Kyle Larson, he has a similar as well with his grandfather.
Right.
He told me about it, and it's very cool for me. Cars are special, are important for me.
yeah.
For me, I don't know. It's hard for me to get rid of the cars. And, I just like them a lot. I take care of them a lot, and I don't know. For me, it was very cool to finally get this boss back and to see that big smile on my face. And I brought the boss. Actually, the boss right now is in my mom's house. And my mom, when she jumped in the boss, she said, "Hey, Daniel, this thing still smells the same than 25 years ago." and the guy, actually, my father say, "You know what? The guy did a good job. You know, to do not do anything to the bus." I mean, the guy, he was a guy that he liked the bus, but he didn't use it. I mean, my dad told me, "Hey, if the guy put 3,000 miles to the bus in 25 years, I think it's a lot." I mean, the guy didn't do anything, nothing. The same tires that my dad sold it to.
That's crazy.
So my dad say, that's a bad thing. Yeah. But I feel that for us, it's a good thing because he didn't touch it. He didn't do anything to that thing. You know, a couple of things, scratches and stuff like that, but now that we got it, and now that we have our shop, we're going to make sure that bus, you know, becomes again, because we're going to restore the whole thing.
Yeah.
We're going to make that thing again the best bus in Mexico.
Now, you mentioned that you don't obviously get to Mexico that often to see it. Your dad made this special trip up for the Father's Day piece I was talking about. How often do you see the family or get to go back these days?
Not very often. Every time that I can, I try to go there or they come. My mom was just here maybe a month ago. She spent a few weeks here. My sisters came as well for 1 week. And, you know, it's a little bit tough, but that's part of my life. You know, it's part of racing. It's part of, you know, being a Mexican driver in a different country. It's much better right now than 5 years ago. 5 years ago, I didn't have the money to go and travel over there. And at least right now, I'm busy. Not because I can't afford it. So, you know, it's been much better. You know, every time that I have the opportunity, I try to go to see my family, my friends, and to have a good time. But yeah, it's been something that, you know, I wish they were here. But, you know, they have all of them. They have already their lives made over there, and it's very hard to make a transition. I did it because, you know, I love racing, but it's not easy to start again.
It's partially because you're busy. You're racing, you know, 36 weeks a year here in Cup, but you also talked recently about getting your residency status in America. And are there stipulations that you have to stay in America, I think, for a certain continuous period, like 6 months in a row or something like that?
Yeah, it's exactly actually 6 months. Okay. And actually yesterday, it's funny that you mentioned that, because yesterday my attorney called me. And, you know, it's a long process.
Yeah, I remember you talking about this.
You have to go through a lot of process. And actually, I'm pretty much approved because they gave me already the pending green card, because I can travel with that. So I already passed the 6 months period that I couldn't travel. But yesterday, my attorney called me and she said that I'm having the interview to get the green card, which we are pretty much in the last steps of, you know, getting that thing. So, yeah, it's been a long process. It's way longer than what I thought.
Yeah.
You know, good thing I'm not in a rush, honestly. but yeah, it's been good, and hopefully we can get that thing done and just forget about it a little bit.
When you talked about it, Chicagoland, I wrote about it then and did a little bit of research. I mean, I had no idea that, and when I posted a link to the story, I got a lot of feedback on social media from other people saying, you know, this is a very difficult and costly process. It's not something that many people trying to become permanent resident status can afford, both in time and money. It's more than $10,000 in attorney's fees. Why is it worth it for you? Is it just the hassle of just being on a visa? Is it's just easier just to be a permanent resident?
There is different reasons. I have a very, very special visa that actually not a lot of people has. It's a visa that they call it a special talent visa. Every time I go crossing the border with my visa, they say, "Man, or either I never seen one of these, or I haven't seen one of these in a long time," all the time. So it's very unique.
It's generally only open to like athletes or
correct
people.
Yeah, the only people
things.
I know yeah. that has that visa is either athletes, professional athletes, or big TV people. I have a friend of mine that he works in Miami, in one of the Hispanics, big Univision. He works over there, and he's from Mexico, so Univision brought him here, and he got that visa. He's the only person I know that has that visa. So it's a special visa. But even with that, the visa is good for 3 years. But every year you have to do like a little renew, like telling them, hey, I'm gonna keep staying in the U.S. Like every year, just like a check-in. And after those 3 years, you have to go through all the process again. And I did already that twice. So, and it's expensive, and you have to go to interviews again. And you never know. I mean, if you get a guy that you don't like, that the guy doesn't like you a lot, or for
The guy
whatever
who's
you want,
interviewing you or asking you the questions, yeah.
yeah. I mean, he can say, hey, no, you're not getting the visa this time.
Right.
Or who can say, you know what, I'm not feeling good about this. You're gonna get another interview.
Yeah.
And normally those interviews, I was having those interviews when I was renewing that thing every 3 years. I was having those interviews either in December or January. So my manager one day told me, hey, then if one day you get an issue on that, I mean, you are racing in February. I mean, you're gonna be in trouble, and you have a
Right.
contract to race.
Right.
So you better make sure that that is out of the question, you know. So the only way to do that was either it was to make the next step into the green card, into the to being a resident. And with the visa I have, most of the visas you have to wait like 5 years to apply for a resident. And with the visa I have, because it was a special visa, I had to wait only 3 years. So one process of my visa. But honestly, at the time I didn't care. It was way more expensive to get a green card, and it was more long and all that kind of stuff. So I said, nah, I'm gonna stay with the visa. I don't care. So I got the visa twice, no, three times, and finally, my attorney and my manager told me, you know what, we have to do this because it's gonna be better for you, and you won't have to renew this thing almost ever again. I think it lasts like
10
10 years
years?
or
I think 10
something.
years, yep. Yeah.
So you're gonna be out of trouble, and you can come in and out whenever you want, and nobody will say anything that may keep you in one side or the other.
Yeah.
So okay, let's do it. So we started this process over a year ago, and finally right now we are, I feel like, in the last stage of it.
About to get the final approval. So, do you feel more a part of a country when you achieve that kind of status and you don't have to worry about constantly like reapplying for visas? Does it change your perception at all, or?
Well, I don't really think about it, but every time I can have, if I want to, I can have dual citizenship.
That was gonna be my next question,
Yeah,
because
but
I mean, after 5 years of having a green card, you could apply
correct.
for citizenship.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends. Actually, my grandmother, she's like that because her father was born in the United States, so she has dual citizenship. But for me, it's something that is not my priority. But if one day I see something beneficial from it, I will do it. But for now, like I said, it took me longer than what it should to get my green card or my residency. I don't know. We see. I guess I will find out as I go. But I guess it's gonna be way easier just to don't worry about a visa every 3 years, or do the check-in every year. It's just different. Actually, the visa I had, it was so special that the check-in every year, I didn't have to do it. If I wasn't living the United States for more than 4 weeks, I could stay with a little sticker expire, but with a visa issued kind of thing, good for the 3 years. So actually, I never did the check-in either because I wasn't out of the country for more than 4 weeks. So it was kind of like a funny process. But some people in the border, there is a lot of people that know all those details, and some people don't. So a couple times I had issues because my paper was expired, but the actual visa it wasn't. So a lot of people say, hey, no, this thing is expired. You can come through. I
Wow.
say, well, the visa is not. No, you can come through. I say, well, check with your supervisor because actually I know I can. I check specific this detail. Somebody else came and said, no, he's right because of this special visa. I say, oh, okay, I'm sorry, I didn't know that. I say, well, that's fine. But a lot of people doesn't know that. And if one day one guy, he doesn't want to call the supervisor or whatever,
yeah,
I can be out. So we want to avoid that.
Yeah, obviously, the green card would certainly help you do that, as would citizenship. And, I mean, presumably, you will still be here in 5 years yeah. and racing full-time, I would think, if things go according to plan. So you mentioned the dual citizenship thing. Is it important to maintain your identity as a Mexican national if you were to become an American citizen as well?
And I think, actually, I don't really know how it works,
yeah.
But I think when you do your dual citizenship, you are not giving up the one that you have. But, you know, for me, I have been always very proud to tell people where I came from and how I got here and everything. And I will never be, you know, open to say, hey, no, I'm not Mexican anymore or anything like that. No, I'm very proud for where I came from my background and everything. And that's who I am.
Immigration obviously has been a hot topic in this country and in the news for the last year, Daniel. Do your experiences with it, having to go through the border process and, like you said, having sometimes issues with making sure you get through on the visa, that you're showing the paperwork's correct, does it inform your thoughts about the issue and about what people go through?
You know, the United States is a great country, and I feel like it's something I really like about this country is that is very, very diverse. You know, everywhere you go, you see people from everywhere, either from Mexico, from Cuba, from Puerto Rico, from Colombia, from everywhere. And that's something actually I really like, obviously from the United States, as everyone. But it's something I really like a lot. And you know, it's a country that you get a lot of opportunities and a lot of people like it. That's why a lot of people try to come here. That's the truth. And you know, sometimes it's hard to do it some ways. And you know, I guess I don't really know. I mean, it's difficult to be sometimes in my position because I know I'm doing it in the right way. But at the same time, you know, it's just a hard topic because it doesn't matter what you say, you can make some people
right
happy and you can make some people mad. So I just prefer to stay away from it. I don't really like to all that kind of stuff.
I mean, everybody's situation is different as
Correct.
Well. So like what you're dealing with and facing with is going to be completely different from millions, literally millions of other people.
Correct.
Everybody's situation different.
And you know, when I see, because I'm living this, when I see all the amount of money that I'm spending to do things the right way, not getting my visa, the next process, getting my green card, to do things the right way, the amount of money I'm spending, I say this in an interview, I'm not surprised people is trying to avoid that because it's a lot of money.
Sure.
I mean, if I didn't have the money, I wouldn't do it. I prefer to spend that money on my, you know, if I have a family, on my family or children or whatever. But it's a lot of money. I wish that process was easier and cheaper because not a lot of people can afford that.
One more question about coming to this country. I know that you barely knew any English when you arrived. You learned through subtitles on cartoons.
Well, cartoons was very important, and watching movies with subtitles in English was very important as well. I used to, not anymore, but I used to read quite a bit in English just to try to get some words. Because at one point, when I was, you know, getting some of my English, I was getting decent talking and listening, but I wasn't able to write at all. I wasn't able to text someone. When every time I was writing an email, I didn't know how.
Yeah.
So
conversational English is the same.
Correct.
You can speak it, but you can't.
I feel like the first number one is understanding. Number two is talking. Number three is writing. Mm-hmm. So the number three, by the time that the number one and two were moving forward, the number three was in zero still. So I thought, man, I'm in trouble here. So I started reading because to try to fix that and actually start helping me some. For that reason as well, I started to put subtitles on my movies on English to read that, to listen and to read. So that helped me a lot. But yeah, that was tough. That was one of the times that I say, man, I don't think I'm going to make it because I needed to learn it quick and I didn't have the time and I didn't have the money to get special classes or anything like that. So it was a little difficult, but it worked out.
What were some books or movies that stayed with you or cartoons? Anything in particular that
you know, I used to watch so much and so many. That was I had like a homework per day. I remember that. I used to watch at least 2 movies per day. You know, at the time I didn't have a lot of responsibility, so I didn't have a lot to do during the day, just to go to a shop maybe and then come back and work out, and that was it. So I used to watch two movies per day and read a little bit at night. I remember I used to buy a magazine, race, NASCAR magazine, just to read. The first magazine I bought was the one that Tony Stewart won the championship. What year was that?
That would have been 2011.
Okay, that was the first magazine I bought to read. I remember that because he was on the how you say that, on the kind of like on the top of the magazine. So that was the first magazine I bought to
Okay.
read, and he was on it, so he
On the
won that
cover.
championship. Yeah,
Okay.
on the
That's
cover,
cool.
correct.
You mentioned the people that have helped you in doing this, and your PR representative, Tyler, was telling me about a guy who kind of serves as your manager named Gustavo. Am I
Gustavo, yeah.
Gustavo? Okay. And that he helped you when you were in the racing program in Mexico and now has continued to provide guidance here in America. And he's so close to you that you actually call him
Grandfather, yeah.
grandfather. And how important has he been in your development?
You know, there is another funny story about him, because he's a person that came from the big company business. He used to be the vice president of two big companies for a long time, and he's a very successful person. And it happens that he likes racing. When I moved to the United States the very first time, I went to a very, very small race team, and he was little part owner of that racing. I don't know, maybe 20, 30% owner of that race team. I raced with that racing for three or four races. That was it. But we become friends. He was Colombian, I was Mexican, so we used to speak Spanish. And that was, you know, for whatever reason, every time that you find someone that you can speak your first language, you just connect quicker. And we were speaking Spanish, and we become friends. And then, you know, I had to leave him and his team, and I move on, and I start looking my own opportunities. And we kind of like, you know, we were friends, but we disconnect for a year and a half. And then later on, when I was racing, we got in contact again, and you know, he started helping me with some sponsors and with some direction, with some people. And he was helping me just because he liked me, no, for anything less. And then, you know, things started to go better, and he was helping me more and more and more. And you know, one day we decided to start working together, you know, professional work together, not just as a friend. And right now he's my manager, and he's someone that's he's been helping me a lot in the you know, outside of the racetrack, and in the racetrack as well. But just to make the right decisions, it's very important to have the right people on your side on racing. And he doesn't know a lot about racing, but he does know a lot about sponsors and business and in the corporate world. So see, is where he came from, and I feel like it's very valuable to have someone like him on my side.
I'm
So.
sure he played a big role last year when suddenly, hey, by the way, we're going to thrust you into the Cup Series
Oh,
when you learn
correct.
that a few weeks out from the season.
Yeah, correct. I mean, he's been playing a huge role, and he has a great relationship with coach. And something extremely important is that Telcel in Mexico, that they've been on my side as well since my first year in NASCAR in Mexico. It happened that Gustavo has a connection with them, because long time ago, when the director of Telmex was racing, which is obviously as well kind of like my manager, but in the racing side, when he was racing, Gustavo was in the corporate world, and Gustavo used to sponsor him with Telmex. So Gustavo used to sponsor these guys, so that's why they connect as well. So it was very funny, because I connect with Gustavo here, and then Gustavo had a connection over there, so it was kind of like a very good connection overall. So he has a very good connection with everyone in Mexico, because he used to sponsor them
Right.
many years ago.
Right.
They know him very well. They have a lot of respect for him, and they know that, you know, we work together. And he's a very, very good person. Obviously, now he has a great relationship with coach and with a lot of people in the industry.
And obviously your support in Mexico helps a lot in terms of you with that sponsorship getting to the Cup Series. When you went back to Mexico, Daniel, right after you won the Xfinity Championship in 2016, I remember you went to a race down there as a
Oh yeah.
spectator, and it seemed like you were treated like a god. Like you had
At least that we can.
like 10 or 20,000 people just like rising and just cheering
Yeah.
wildly for you.
Yeah, it was very special. And that happened, actually, you are right. That happened just a couple of weeks after winning the
Right.
championship. So the topic was very hot still. You know, I went to Mexico, and that was the last race of the season for the NASCAR Mexico Series. So I went down there, a lot of people there, and it was in the new Hermano Rodriguez Speedway. So it was a big deal. So we went over there, and you know, a lot of people in Mexico, they know me already because I was racing there. So a lot of people actually follow my path from Mexico to the United States and follow all that. So they knew I was going to be there. So a lot of people went over there to the racetrack, and we got the opportunity to take some pictures and to hang out a little bit. And I really it was a very, very, very cool feeling, something that I have felt just a few times in life. So it was good to get that, and hopefully we can do it again.
In Mexico, is it soccer, motor racing? Like in Brazil, I know it's that way. It's soccer and then motor. Is it
correct.
Same in Mexico?
Yeah. Soccer is huge. Yeah. Everywhere.
Yeah.
Every kid out there that has $10, they can afford a soccer ball. So,
right.
So it's very popular. I play soccer for a long time too, and I love it. It's a lot of fun. But racing is my passion. I just feel like it's extremely difficult and it's a lot of pressure on the driver. So I feel like that was for me. But soccer in Mexico is huge. But racing, like open wheel racing, is been very big in Mexico for a long time. But within the last 10 years, I will tell you that NASCAR is getting up there too. And I'm happy to be a small part of it.
Well, obviously, a Cup Series victory would certainly draw that same response. And you're heading to Michigan, coming off two straight top fives. I can't help but notice that Michigan is where you got your first win in the Xfinity Series. You feel a little more confident going back to that track this weekend?
You know, when you have momentum, doesn't matter where you go, you feel confident. And the team right now has momentum. I feel that I do have momentum. We have to keep it up, take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. We have to make the next 4 weeks the best 4 weeks of our year, and try to make it happen. Because definitely we didn't have first few months of racing that we were expecting at all. But now things are going in the right direction, so we have to take advantage of it. And I'm confident that things are going to work out in our way.
Is it pretty much win and you're in at this point? I mean, the playoffs aren't really points. It's going
to
have
no. I don't even look to the points anymore. I'm thinking about winning. That's all I care about.
Good luck to you with that goal. Thanks for being on here. Really appreciate it. Enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Nathan. I appreciate it.
The NASCAR NBC podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts. As always, if you have any feedback, you can leave it for me on Twitter @NateRyan. Thanks for listening to the NASCAR NBC podcast.